Bonsoir, bienvenue à Paris.
Hi, Allison.
Hi, Sarah. So, I'm going to start us off with this. Remember this?
Lady Gaga, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the Olympic ceremony in Paris this summer.
Yep, dressed in full pink feather combo, she was performing the 1965 song Mon Truc en Plume by French cabaret artist Zizi Jeanmaire. The Paris Olympics and Paralympics weren't just a showcase for sporting prowess and, of course, Paris monuments. They also gave massive exposure to music in French. During the opening ceremony, one of the standouts, for me anyway, was French Malian star Aya Nakamura singing a medley alongside the Republican Guard Orchestra. It was a clever response to the racism she'd faced ahead of the Olympics from the far right, that somehow she wasn't French enough to perform at the Olympics. She dealt them a cheeky blow with her interpretation of Charles Aznavour's Formidable. And Sarah, you'd need a heart of stone not to have been a little bit moved by Céline Dion's version of Edith Piaf's Hymne à l'amour to close the opening ceremony.
Le ciel bleu sur nous peut s'effondrer.
The day after Dion's performance, on top of the Eiffel Tower, streaming of that Piaf song went up by 320% worldwide.
So did all this music at the opening ceremony, also the closing ceremony, I mean, are we seeing sort of this increase in interest in French music or songs in French abroad?
Yeah, but it was already building up, in fact. It was an existing trend, helped along in recent years by streaming platforms, increasingly sophisticated videos, and of course now on YouTube you can get translations done automatically, whether they're good or not, but there's less of a language barrier. Recent data from Spotify shows that 100 million of its users worldwide had listened to at least one song in French over the last year, and the flow of francophone music has nearly doubled in the last 5 years.
Well, that seems to go against this trend, apparently, that the French language is in decline as English continues to rise.
Mais non! Well, at least not everywhere. French is still the fifth most widely spoken language in the world. 320 million people speak it. And among the non-French speakers, the desire to learn French is often generated through song. So the question is, what makes someone who doesn't speak la langue de Molière want to listen to songs in French?
This question has never been addressed before by a book or a radio or a TV in France.
That's music journalist Bertrand Dical, and he set about answering that question in an exhibit he's curated at the brand new International Centre for the French Language in the Villers-Cotterêts Château east of Paris. I met him there, and it turns out that non-French speakers are not necessarily looking for the same things as the French, and they're particularly drawn to female artists, which the exhibit is highlighting.
The big issue is that French-speaking songs are telling something about France that we in France are not always keen to hear, are not always aware. For instance, the fact that the French singer is a woman, definitely. Aya Nakamura, Juliette Gréco, Edith Piaf, Céline Dion, Mireille Mathieu. Some men, of course, Henri Salvador, Georges Moustaki, Charles Aznavour, of course, but mainly women, because the reason why people are listening to French-speaking songs, to French songs, is a dream. They are dreaming about France. They are dreaming about the Champs-Élysées, the Château de Versailles, the love, the romantic part of France, and of course, women. All the clichés, but some very interesting clichés. Why those women that have in common to be hated by the conservative part? For instance, Aya Nakamura and Juliette Gréco and Françoise Hardy, they have in common that the extreme right used to hate them because they are a part of a French way to be a woman, that is, being free, choose their man, wear very beautiful dresses while being totally free. They are not dolls. They are real, tough, powerful women. And it is a story of empowerment. Long before Me Too and long before this kind of nowadays feminism, even Edith Piaf was some kind of a feminist icon abroad.
We're here now in front of the section which opens up the exhibition, and it features Aya Nakamura, so this Malian-born French singer who has become, I think, the most streamed French artist ever.
Yes, in India, in Costa Rica, in Bahrain, she is the first French singing artist ever charted. More than 100 countries around the world where she has a success. And it is not because she's some kind of a subversive way of being French. No, that's because she is French with her beautiful dresses, with her makeup, with her way to say no to men, with her glamour, with a very special way to say je t'aime. And what is amazing and what is dramatically complicated to understand for the extreme right in France is that Aya Nakamura is France. Abroad, she is totally French. It's only in France that we say, oh, well, she is Malian, which is a way to say she's black. She's coming from...
She's an immigrant.
She's coming from the suburbs, which is another way to say she's black. It's only in France. It is seen as negative, but abroad, she is a black Marie Antoinette singing in le Château de Versailles.
C'est une chanson qui nous ressemble. Toi, tu m'aimais et je t'aimais.
You chose to put Aya Nakamura in the same room as Juliette Gréco from a very different period. What was the kind of connection for you?
It's the same love and it's the same hate. We've got to remember that the conservative and the extreme right in France were very upset with Juliette Gréco. It was a woman with a free hair, with a life with free love. She decided everything. She was singing very left-wing offers and in the same time very classical offers in French poetry. She was some kind of a sex symbol and in the same time she was some kind of a Jean-Paul Sartre singing. And it was a real scandal in the 50s. Almost like Aya Nakamura right now. People were saying, I am ashamed that Juliette Gréco is singing in New York and Berlin and in Rio de Janeiro and people are saying this is the French culture. Yes, she's a French culture. And it's the same with Françoise Hardy in the 60s. It's the same with some kind of a Zaz right now in the French more classical songs.
So these women in particular have helped massively to take French song to an international level and make it well known. And at the same time, they're not really reflecting France at all. They're reflecting foreigners' idea of what France is. There is this dream that's being sold through song. Is that right?
What we are listening when we French people are listening to Elvis Presley or Beyonce, this is not the real United States, it's the actual United States. We're listening to a dream. And the French dream, it is what is brought to people by the songs. And always a dream of freedom and glamour.
Monsieur le Président, je vous fais une lettre. Que vous lirez peut-être si vous avez le temps.
Now, this exhibition isn't all about glamour, because there's also a section that's devoted to the street. There have been a few big songs that have been more politically engaged. One of them is Le Déserteur, based on a text by Boris Vian.
Monsieur le Président, je ne veux pas la fête.
Le Déserteur is a song that was brought to the world by American singers, Peter, Paul and Mary, who were singing it in French in the beginning of the Vietnam War, of the American Vietnam War. And this song is one of the biggest international pacifist songs. It is a tradition in itself, in French or even in foreign languages. And Daria Nelson is a Ukrainian artist living in France, and she decided, in the context of the Russian war against Ukraine, to sing it in Russian for the Russian to hear it while they are called to go to the army. And it has been translated in so many languages, but with something weird, that many of those translations are unknown, are clandestine. It is a song which is very often sung in the clandestinity, in political groups. It's an underground song, and at the same time, a very popular and well-known and even commercial song. That's all the ambiguity of popular songs.
Does it matter that the songs in French that have been nominated for Grammys or have got onto the top of the US Billboard, does it matter that they didn't come out of France, but they came out of Belgium, they came out of Mali with Amadou and Mariam, they came out of other French-speaking countries? Does that matter, or is francophonie what matters?
The thing that is the most difficult to understand for French people is that our language is not only our language. Many people sing and dream and speak and write and read our language. Even people that we don't like, even people that we are not friends with, of course. It is the language that we brought to the world, and it belongs to the world right now. I don't have to say to a Malian or to a Canadian or to a Lebanese that he doesn't speak the good, the proper French. That's his language.
And Creole, you devote some space to Cassav, that amazing band from Guadeloupe.
I have a special point of view on Cassav and Creole because I'm from Guadeloupe and I am a Creole myself. It's something weird for French people to understand that the group that played in the most countries in the history of music is Cassav. They've played in more than 80 countries or something like that. Only DJs in electronic music can do the same. It is very important to say that coming from the tragedy, the awful crime of slavery, there is this music and this language, the French Creole. It is something which really makes people optimistic about the future of our language.
So, Sarah, a couple of fun facts from that exhibition. What was the first song in French to make it to number one in the US?
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, I didn't know either before I saw the exhibition. It's Dominique by Sœur Sourire, known as the Singing Nun in English.
Oh, I have to take your word on that one.
Yeah, that was back in the 1960s. One thing that made my jaw drop as a Brit is that we owe the hit song Champs-Élysées to a 1960s British psychedelic band called Jason Crest.
She took me down this avenue where I met the folks she knew, and there we stopped and chatted and we passed the time away.
The song is Waterloo Road, and it's a rootsy song that maybe you might more likely sing down the pub. It was a complete flop, as was the band, but it did lead to the Joe Dassin recording that we all know, with his promise of romance as you stroll down the chic Champs-Élysées. We who live in Paris now know the Champs are not quite what they used to be, but as Dical said, songs in French are all about selling dreams.
Combien de mers franchiras
bien, mon ami. Écoute dans le vent, écoute la réponse dans le vent.
So now let's turn to some more French contributions to the world now, but not musicians. This in the field of chemistry, physics, medicine, economics, literature, and peace.
Yeah, Nobel Prizes. Mm-hmm. It is the season. There haven't been any French winners among the prizes announced so far this week, but France's Nobel history goes back to the first awards in 1901.
And Jess Phelan is here to tell us about it. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Sarah. Hi, Alison.
Hi.
Yeah, so France is actually fourth in the Nobel medal table overall. Its strongest category is physics. 17 French physicists have won over the decades, most recently last year.
And the most famous has got to be Marie Curie.
Yes. So she shared France's first physics prize in 1903 with her husband, Pierre Curie, and the fellow scientist Henri Becquerel for their research into radioactivity. And she was 36 at the time, and winning that Nobel really helped the Curies establish their reputation and secure the resources they needed to keep experimenting. So after Pierre died a few years later, Marie Curie became the first female professor at the University of Paris, and she got her own research lab, is now known as the Curie Institute. And she went on to win another Nobel Prize in 1911, this time in chemistry, for her discovery of the elements radium and polonium.
And didn't her daughter win a Nobel too?
Yeah, so Marie and Pierre's daughter, Irène Joliot-Curie, and her husband, Frédéric, they together won the chemistry prize in 1935 for their discovery that you can use radiation to turn stable materials radioactive. So that means between them, the Curie family has five Nobel Prizes.
Overachievers.
Totally. I mean, needless to say, there hasn't been anyone quite like the Curies since. But to give you an idea of some of the contributions that French Nobel winners have made to science and medicine, their work has included discovering the parasite that causes malaria, developing a technique to stitch blood vessels together, inventing particle detectors, and identifying the HIV virus.
All right, that's all science-y. What about other fields?
So four French economists have won Nobels, most recently Esther Duflo in 2019, who helped develop an experimental approach to alleviating global poverty. But France has had 10 winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, and I'm curious to know whether you can name any of them.
The only thing I can vaguely remember that the medical NGO Doctors Without Borders got something, but when?
Yep. I mean, to be honest, I didn't recognize many names on the list, given the sort of big hitters that have won it since. French ones are not necessarily people you'd recognize. But a Frenchman actually won the first ever Nobel Peace Prize in 1901. Frédéric Passy, he was the founder of the International League of Peace and Freedom, which was a kind of precursor to the United Nations. He shared it with Jean-Henri Dunant of Switzerland, who was the co-founder of the Red Cross. And later there were various people who tried to prevent World War One and then World War Two.
That didn't work out quite as well as it should have.
No, but A for effort, I guess, or a Nobel for effort. And then after the war, Léon Jouhaud won. He was an influential trade union leader who helped establish the labour movement in France and internationally. Then there was the medical missionary, Albert Schweitzer, who set up a hospital in Gabon. René Cassin, who helped draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the last French winner, as you remembered, Alison, was in 1999, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, the medical charity.
So that just leaves literature.
Yeah, and France actually has more Nobel Prizes for literature than any other country, 16.
Not that much of a surprise, I suppose. France does have a lot of famous writers.
Yeah, but they're not necessarily the ones who have won. So the prize in the early days actually went to a lot of people who aren't that well known today. So in 1901, when the Nobels were created, lots of people thought that the literature prize should go to Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist. Nope. Instead, the first winner for literature was Sully Prudhomme. He's a classical French poet. Have you ever read anything by him?
No, not at all.
Pregnant pause. No.
Yeah, I mean, he's he's fine. He's no Tolstoy. And 40 of Sweden's biggest writers were so upset about that decision that they wrote to Tolstoy and said it should, the first Nobel should have gone to him.
Yeah. It wouldn't be the last time people were unhappy, would it, about the jury's choice. The literature prize, really, yeah, it's so subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And especially at first, the judges had a preference for what they called idealism rather than realism. So the year that Sully Prudhon won, he was also up against the French novelist Émile Zola. But Zola was considered too naturalist, too political maybe. So Zola actually never ended up winning. Neither did Marcel Proust, arguably the most influential French writer of all time. Tolstoy never got his Nobel either, by the way. But the jury did start taking a few more risks as the years went by. They picked André Gide, the humanist writer, and Albert Camus, the author of The Stranger and The Plague, and Jean-Paul Sartre, the great existentialist. He's actually the only person so far to turn down the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1964 because he said he didn't want to become too institutional and that it wasn't fair that it always went to Western writers.
Fair enough. And also to male writers, from the sounds of it.
Yes. Yep. It wasn't until 2022 that a French woman finally won, the novelist Annie Ernaux.
Il y a en France et partout dans le monde des intellectuels masculins pour qui les livres écrits par les femmes n'existent tout simplement pas.
That's her giving her Nobel lecture, and she says, in France and everywhere, there are male intellectuals for whom books written by women simply do not exist. They never cite them. And she said that her prize should be a sign of justice and hope for all female writers.
So now we're going to turn to school and this very tricky question of screens in school.
Oh, tell me about it. It's an issue we are all grappling with, aren't we, here and I guess all over the world.
Yeah. And so some places are passing laws to limit, you know, social media usage for young people. But at school, it's a different issue. In many schools in the U.S., for example, screens are a mainstay in classrooms. Then there's Sweden, which last year decided it was actually removing screens after embracing them.
But it seems like the situation here in France is a bit less clear.
Yeah. French schools have been slower on the uptake in technology. A lot of the reason is a lack of coordination, despite the fact that we have this very centralized education system. And that disorganization might be a blessing in disguise, sort of allowing more time maybe to consider the consequences. Already, school use, what we're talking about in school, is focused mostly in high schools, the lycée. These are students age 15 and up. Lycées are managed by the regions. They're 18 in France. And so each region decides on its digital policy. In 2020, the Paris region made digital textbooks available to all of its 470 high schools. And they bought tablets for all the students. And today, about half of general high schools in the Paris region have taken them on. But the use of these tablets and computers varies by teacher, by student, by school. I visited a private high school west of Paris that gets funding from the region and has been giving tablets to students since 2020. I wanted to see how it works out in a classroom.
Part-time job. In French, the French word for part-time job.
This is a management class, an elective for first-year students being taught in English. This morning, they're working on vocabulary.
Okay. So now you just have to fill in the missing words, okay?
The 15-year-olds in this classroom are studying a business pitch so that later they can come up with one of their own.
Okay. Who can explain what is the main... can explain the business model of this company?
Part of the lesson involves watching a bad pitch from an episode of the TV series Parks and Recreation.
Before the activity, we see what is a bad pitch, okay?
Okay, you guys pretend you're Ron Swanson.
The show gets projected on the whiteboard at the front of the class. About half of the students have tablets propped up on their desks in front of them, though they've been working on the vocabulary exercises on pieces of paper. Lisa, who says she has a computer and a phone at home, uses her tablet for schoolwork.
For all the work for school, I always use a tablet. So we use it a lot to have access to exercises. We don't have any test book at school. Everything's on the tablets.
The teacher, Christophe, says he could have had the students do the vocabulary work on their tablets.
It could have been possible for me to download the document, as they could have done the exercise with their iPad. But first, I'm sure that 50% couldn't get a connection to get it effectively. And even if they get the document, after how they can do to find the document again to make revisions. Once you have studied something, you need to take it before test. If they use only digital tools, all their documents are somewhere in the cloud, and they're not enough mature to store their files and after to print them.
A 20-year veteran teacher, Christophe has been pushed to use technology for years. And when the tablets entered his school in 2020, at first he was very open to it.
Traditional books are not perfect. Sometimes they are heavy, and sometimes students forgot their books. So at the beginning, I thought it can be a solution, okay? But I was too much disappointed with these screens.
There were technical problems, Wi-Fi connectivity issues, students who didn't have the right login codes for their tablets, or whose tablets just weren't charged. Once the tech problems were out of the way, the students then were distracted.
When we started the lesson, and I saw that maybe 50% of students did another thing that they were supposed to do. These are systems to avoid this problem, but they are smarter than we are, okay? So they always find a solution to do other activities. So they were not focused on the task. The teacher has to make students improve, to make them work, to make them analyze, to make them face difficulties and to find solutions to make them listen to other students speaking. We are here to develop their concentration, to develop their attention, and these skills are very important. And when you give a screen to a teenager, you can be sure that he doesn't hear you, he doesn't listen to you, he is focused on the screen.
Today, Christophe does use some technology, a projector in particular, but the work is pretty much all done on paper.
We can do interactive activities. They can speak, but when they work, they have a piece of paper, they have to focus on the document, and so it's easy for me to check they do the exercise, to help students who can't do this exercise, because I don't have to manage a technical problem.
Okay, so who can read the first sentence?
For most of his non-elective classes, which are bigger than this one, with 25 to 30 students, Christophe insists that the tablets be put away.
Their tablets have to stay in their bags. I think it's the only use maybe once a month when I make quizzes online. But it's not to learn. It's just a sort of reward because they worked hard before. It's just to have fun.
Last year, Christophe helped found a collective for a reasonable digital education, they call themselves, in order to question the increased use of screens in schools in France. They saw policy decisions that seemed to be both considering the negative impacts of screens on kids in general, but also continuing to push their use in schools. President Emmanuel Macron commissioned an expert report on the use of screens by young people, and the experts earlier this year recommended limits on screens, on smartphones, on social media. The education ministry is experimenting with banning personal phones at school, but the question of screens in the classroom themselves remains a really big debate. The report, for example, points to a complete lack of coordination between the education ministry and local authorities who are in charge of buying equipment. Christophe, who's seen the push for the use of technology in high schools in Ile-de-France, is frustrated by the mixed messages that are being sent to kids.
Their parents say, don't use your screen, and at school, use your screen. It's not logical. They can't understand. They need a clear message.
Schools, he says, should be a respite.
I think school should help parents to free their kids from phones. So we know that they are addicted to smartphones, to screens. And when they're at school, it should be a period, a free period, without screens.
Some of the students themselves have even identified this, like Charles, who says that he plays a huge amount of video games outside of school, sometimes 2 to 3 hours a day.
Sometimes I even forget to do my homework. So when I'm in I'm in school, I just focus, and when I'm in my home, I just like play video games to de-stress from the day.
So on some level, having a screen in school, you kind of want to push it away to just have a screen-free time.
Yeah, it's really literally like that. It's just my screen-free time. I just like don't want to have a screen around me for school so I can be more focused, because in school, we learn the most.
His classmate, Carlette, learned to put his own limits on his screen time.
But I noticed, like, when I was in 6th grade and 7th grade, that I was having way too much time on my phone, and I kind of put myself time control of screen time, and I noticed it's a lot way more and it's better. In a way that you socialize and use that time on your phone to do stuff that you wouldn't usually do. Like, I would have spent hours on social media, and if I had to do a research for a program for school or something like that, I would have done it like at 9 p.m.
Okay, so we will listen to this for a second time. We can have a look at the document.
Christophe, the teacher, doesn't completely reject technology. He recognizes that students do use it and need to know how to use it well. In fact, he thinks that's how it should be used in schools, taught as its own subject.
We make a clear distinction between digital solutions as a tool to learn and digital performances. We think that they need to learn digital skills. They need digital skills, and we think it's necessary to have class to study computer science. And we want schools having classes with computers so they can learn how to use Word, to use how to organize their files, how to use internet, how to do, of course. So we want class with digital tools to learn digital abilities, but we don't want the use of digital tools as a way to study other subjects.
So the Paris region is pushing screens in high schools, though I have to say my daughter is in one of those schools that has not picked up on it. Mm. But this isn't the case everywhere, right?
Yeah. Like I said, each region does its own thing. So, for example, the Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes region in the southeast, this includes the city of Lyon, they decided last year to go back on digital and provide paper textbooks for free to all schools that want them. So a recognition that perhaps digital isn't all that. Statistics from 2022 show that the average number of mobile devices per high school student was 24 per 100 students. So that's a quarter. It means a lot of places don't have them at all. Primary schools have even fewer, an average of 4 desktop computers per 100 students, and no mobile devices, which many experts say probably should stay that way. We've come to the end of the show. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. If you want to send us a message, please do. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
And you can find us and subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app. And please consider rating and reviewing us. We'd love to hear what you think. We're also on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
We're taking a break and we'll be back in a month on Thursday, November the 7th. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison.